Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast with me, Sam Harris, your host. I invite fascinating humans from all walks of life to share their wisdom and unpack their mindsets and formulas for growth. Hello and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today we are revisiting one of my favorite episodes from the past with Igor Volzanin. He is an entrepreneur and philosopher who was building a company to help businesses personalize their messaging and increase their response rates and customer satisfaction and retention and things, and essentially a marketing company that I didn't think I would find all that interesting. But he actually had a very fascinating story and a lot of deep lessons and principles that really stuck with me. He'd learned a lot about people and always took things back to the first principles of psychology and behavior, which is a brilliant way to go through life in general. And he really thought about risks and how to really optimize them for success. So I am now delighted to announce that last year, Igor was able to sell his company DataSign to Shutterstock. So congratulations to him. And I hope that some of the lessons that he gave me in this interview will help you find your own successes. So without further ado, here's my conversation with the extraordinary Igor Volzanin.
So DataSign helps businesses personalize the way they communicate with their customers. We do that by analyzing first-party data that a business already has in their customer to create a personality profile. And then we provide automated recommendations through our platform to tailor content to make it more appealing to different personalities. Some businesses, currently a lot of them, will just send out a single email to a million customers. And what they're trying to do is just optimize the number of customers that buy the product, rather than using that as an opportunity to enhance the relationship. So one thing is cutting down on spam. The second thing is actually delighting the customer.
What have been the big kind of lessons or problems that have come up?
There's been so many. I think it depends on the stage. So at the early stages, it's finding the right co-founders and finding early customers and finding someone that will give you access to their data, someone who believes in you. It's always difficult to kind of do those things at the beginning. Then you get into a phase of, okay, I have the right co-founders and I have some businesses. What am I building? What is the problem and what is the solution to that problem that we're actually building? So that's identifying that and then figuring out why you're so unique and kind of starting to talk about it that way is always quite difficult. And then you have the problem of actually paying for it all, finding investors, raising a round. That's difficult. And then it becomes, well, how do I deal with my early employees? How much do I pay them? What kind of equity should they get? And when it's all kind of just new and exciting and there's like three of you, what happens then? So how do you go from three to six? Same thing with customers. Okay, so we've done one pilot project, but how do I actually turn this into a business and how do we scale? And then it becomes, again, the issue of how do I raise more money to be able to scale faster, to go to more places and do more things? And then where do I find the talent to make it happen?
A lot of things that all sound pretty important. You introduced. Can you break down so how you found co-founders?
So the original co-founder of the company, who's no longer with the company, Bogdan, we met while studying. He had left his job at Deutsche Bank to do a master's in cognition and computation, and I was just starting my PhD at the time. So we met through our supervisor. And we didn't necessarily know what we wanted to do, but we met and we thought, okay, let's do something together. And then we did that for about a year and a half. And then after a year, he had to go back and feed his family. And so he left. But at that point, we had James and Chris, who were some of the earliest people to join the company, who basically stepped up and became the de facto co-founders and who are now kind of full co-founders of the company. So I've gone through that whole thing of finding a co-founder, co-founder leaving, finding new co-founders. So during that first year, neither one of us were super technical. So we spent a very long time trying to find a technical co-founder, but we kind of stumbled into it. Chris, who is now our CTO, he came in through UCL.
Cool. So as a graduate.
Yeah. So the way it happened was we were looking for a data scientist at the time, so we couldn't really pay them.
Yeah. How do you solve that problem?
So yeah, there's kind of stages here and I'm keep jumping back and forth. But if we just take it chronologically, we started the company in February of 2015. In June of 2015, we went to Paris to do a hackathon and hosted by BNP Paribas, which was a bank. And the whole call line of the hackathon was that they would basically provide you transactional data and you show them what you can do in 48 hours. and we showed them what we could do with their data, hypothetically, and they liked it. So we won the hackathon, which gave us about 8,000 euros. And we used that money to rent out a flat in Paris. And the goal was 8,000 is not enough to be able to pay people. So what we're going to do is we were going to rent out a big flat, and then we're going to invite all of our friends and family to come to Paris for as long as they can to help us build a prototype. And that's what we did. So a friend of mine from Canada flew in for a month. Another friend of mine came from Frankfurt for 2 weeks. The son of my co-founder flew in for weekends. And that's what we did. And that was quite fun. It was a really good time. We were just living in Paris, five people in the flat. The flat was fantastic. And we were coding and going to the bank every day and trying to kind of create something. So that was the summer of 2015. Then a year later, so 2016, we got the full project from BNP Paribas, and they paid us 50,000 euros. So that was our first revenue to basically come in and actually take the prototype and actually field test it and see whether personalization would drive engagement and try it on their actual customer base of lots of customers and so on. And we did that. And then at that point, we were able to pay a couple of people from that money to come. And we again rented out, this time a mansion with like six bedrooms and a huge in the middle of Paris. And yeah, it was the same thing. It was great for 2 months. All the people flew in. And then at that point, we were also looking for data scientists and others to join us. And that's how I met James, essentially. He came in and helped us with some of the data science stuff. He was doing his master's at the time. And then he said, look, I have this friend, Chris, who is also doing the master's in machine learning with me from UCL. Would you be interested in talking to him? I think technically he's great and he can help. And then so we met Chris and we really liked him. And then James and Chris became the co-founders.
Thanks, that's like already nice way to start a business and really cool way to solve the problem of getting people to work and you can't pay them.
Yeah, I think that was a lot of fun. It was a very unique time in data science history. I mean, I would recommend everybody to do that. And it's a one way of using very little resources, but then getting people to kind of follow you along.
Yeah, that's really cool. Thanks. Okay, and then how did you then go into getting investment?
Yeah, so investment. Well, we started pitching for our first 100K is what we thought we wanted. So once we won the hackathon, so that was 2015, we started looking for investment from angels here in London mostly. So we pitched to a couple of networks. I can't say that it was going anywhere very fast. People were still telling us that we were too early. They weren't sure what was happening, who's working on it, and so on and so forth. So we really took us until February of 2016 to get our first offer. And that was a term sheet. And I was looking at it recently. So the term sheet was for £40,000 with the condition that they would help us, but we have to raise at least 100. So they would help us raise another 60. And that they would take almost 15,000 of the 40 in monitoring fees and closing fees and in fees. So basically, we were giving up something like 10% of the company for essentially £25,000 check. And so we turned it down and in hopes of getting into Techstars. And we had somebody who introduced us to Max Kelly, who was the managing director of Techstars in London at the time. And we spoke to Max in January, and then we went through the whole interview process in April, May. And then we got into Techstars in June of 2016. And that was quite an important moment. So Techstars provided us with $120,000 as a seed investment. Plus we had revenue from BNP Paribas, and then we had another project with a Belgian bank as well. So we had a bit of money to then give us essentially a 1 year runway. So from June 2016 to June of 2017. So that was the first round, or the first money that we raised essentially into the company.
Okay, cool. Yeah. How do you build a business in terms of finding customers?
We're a B2B business. For most of our history, we have focused on large enterprises. So financial institutions, we're now speaking to telecoms, so large kind of telecom carriers. We're speaking to large e-commerce and retailers and so on. At the same time, we're speaking to smaller companies and looking to bring what we currently do for large businesses to smaller enterprises as well, especially the ones that use MailChimp and HubSpot. I would imagine the most startups die because of the sales cycle. So you have to be very aware that, let's say you're selling to banks, if you are speaking to them today, you will not close a contract, even for a pilot, within the next 6 months. You're just not. And a lot of the time, people will come in and say, look, I'm having all these conversations. The word conversation means you're at least six, probably 12 months away from a contract. As long as you know that and you're okay with that, then it becomes a bit different. Then the game becomes, okay, well, how do I survive long enough to be able to get to 12 months to actually close this contract and to actually do something with them? And so the mindset needs to change. It can't be like, okay, if I don't close this contract within 3 months, I'm dead. That means you're dead. It's, okay, how do I live long enough for the next 12 months, maybe 18, just to be safe, to actually close this contract? So that's one thing. And then the other thing is networking. It still remains the best way of getting early customers for us. Hey, do you know anybody who works for, let's say we sell to banks. Do you know anyone who works at Metro Bank, Lloyd's, RBS? Oh yeah, I do. And my running joke is always, everybody knows someone who works at a bank. You ask anyone, and that is by far the best way. Also the best way to do fundraising. No amount of cold calling or cold emailing will ever get you anywhere. We've tried that as well. But it's usually the networking that gets you the most interesting conversation.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah, I definitely relate to both of those things. That cycle super long. Yeah, so can you tell me a bit about, so you said you had to change your mindset and on the subject of growth mindset.
I had to change my mindset a couple of times. So the first time I had to change my mindset when I had to become a real CEO. So go from a co-founder of a company and the guy who occupies the title of CEO just because there isn't anyone, to actually becoming a CEO. That happened during Techstars, and that happened around the time when my original co-founder was leaving. And then the second time in terms of growth, that started to happen early this year when we closed our seed round. So we raised about €1 million, and I started having a lot more conversations and I started to see patterns. So that was really cool. Our investor, we have several, but one of them is a Russian VC called Sistema. These fantastic investors and they support you. So they invited us and lined up 7 or 8 meetings. So essentially I had almost 3 meetings a day, every day for 3 days with exactly the right people in pretty much all the largest banks in Russia. And all of a sudden, when you do that, you start to see patterns. You start to see exactly who is your customer, what is their problem that you're solving, what kind of questions are they asking you. And you start to see kind of, okay, I can see how this is becoming, what the next steps are, what is the funnel and all of that. So all of a sudden it went from, okay, where we might have one conversation a week with some bank that somebody introduced us to this is becoming a funnel and people are actually interested. And I could see how I could convert out of these 7, 3 into actual projects in the next 3 to 6 months. And what do I need to do to get there? And then the question is, well, how do I replicate this? How do I get my 7 meetings in every single country in Europe? What do I need to achieve that? And then realizing that, okay, there's only so many banks. How do we then kind of go outside of financial services? How do we build our technology in a way that could use other data? And then it kind of starts to snowball, but it still takes a lot of time. And all of these things tend to happen unplanned. It's just all of a sudden you realize that you're in this phase. It's like the book says that at some point, if you're successful, you will reach a growth phase. And then you're like, oh my, this is what they meant. This is the growth phase. Oh, good. What do I do now? So then your mindset starts to change and the goals change for the company. So all of a sudden, it's not enough to get a pilot. It's not enough to have 3 pilots. It's not enough to have a license. It's all of a sudden you have to have $1 million in recurring revenue, and then you have to have 5, and then you have to have 20. And as those goals change, your mind starts to think, okay, well, how do I actually get to 20 million from where I am today in annual recurring revenue? What is that I need to do? How many people do I have to hire? What do these people have to be doing on a daily basis for us to achieve this? And so your mind starts to expand away from how do I build this technology that does something to how do I actually hire 30 people every month for the next 12 months to build a sales force that is capable of delivering these returns. But I think everything comes at its own pace and its own time. And I think we've been lucky enough where we've been going through these phases quite consistently, but also that's the positive for the long sales cycle, is that you normally have enough time to build out whatever it is that you're selling. Even if it's not built yet, normally if you have a long sales cycle, it means that by the time the project actually kicks off, you've had an extra 6 months to build your product to meet the needs. So that meant that we actually had enough time for every phase to really kind of appreciate where we're at, try to find solutions for different problems and move at a good pace.
Yes. So I was going to ask, what do you do in all that time in the 6 month sales cycle when you have that conversation?
As one of our early advisors always said, you always sell first and build later. He said the first thing they ever sold, it was 2 years before they actually built it. And I actually really like that. It sort of goes with the fake it till you make it attitude, but not quite, because that kind of is important in its own right. But in the first instance, you have to have the vision, and you are ultimately selling the vision in the early days. You are selling the vision of what could happen if this existed. And then the customer gets excited about the possibilities of that, buys it, and then thankfully, given that there is a long enough sales cycle, that gives you the opportunity to refine it and then to ultimately build it. While a bank takes a month and a half to do some weird due diligence on you where the company has existed for 3 months, so there's no due diligence to be done, yet somehow it still takes them a month and a half to do that, you are building your product. You are finding out what the pain points are and building that out. So it's almost in your favor if you can survive long enough.
You are probably aware that we have started entering the Great Job Reshuffle. A record number of employees are considering switching jobs, so now is the chance to attract the best. LinkedIn Jobs is here to help you connect with people you want to interview faster and for free. It's been one of the best tools for my company in the last few years, and I can't recommend it highly enough. You can create a free job post in just minutes on LinkedIn Jobs to reach your network and beyond with the world's largest professional network of over 770 million people. Then, add your job and the purple hiring frame to your LinkedIn profile to spread the word that you're hiring so your network can help you find the right people to hire. Small businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs as the number one platform in delivering high quality leads versus competitors because of its simple tools like screening questions that make it easy to focus on candidates with just the right skills. Remember that LinkedIn Jobs helps you find the right candidates for you that you want to talk to faster. And every week, nearly 40 million job seekers visit LinkedIn. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/growth. That's linkedin.com/growth. GROWTH. To post your job for free, terms and conditions apply.
What is the biggest risk you take?
Yeah, I was hoping you'd ask that. And I will tell you this, that I don't feel like anything I've done in the last 5 years was a risk. I think people around me would look at that and say that I'm either delusional or crazy. But I never saw anything. My personal background story in this is that 5 years ago, there's absolutely nothing on this planet that I'd rather be doing today. And well, how is this a risk? I am learning. I am doing the thing that I love. And that's it. There's nothing else to it. I think risk is doing something that you don't want to do and hopes that you will like that.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest risk that a person can take in their lives.
Okay, but what are you worried about doing? The future of the world?
I guess there's a couple of things. My personal worries, I think we're destroying the planet. So I am very worried about what will be left for my children. I'm not even sure there is any point in thinking about their grandchildren, because I don't think even my children will have anything left. I'm very worried about income inequality in the world. I'm extremely worried about the fact that the wealthy own so much of the wealth and the poor own so little. And I think that we're seeing some of the consequences of that already. And I'm also very worried about the fact that people seem to be very angry. I had an interesting conversation with, it was the first billionaire I spoke to ever. So that was kind of cool on its own right, because I don't usually speak to billionaires. But basically, we had an hour-long conversation about politics. So his biggest worry was that Americans have lost optimism, that it was always a country that, despite everything, felt like tomorrow will be a better day than it is today. And they don't feel that way anymore. My worry is slightly different. A lot of the things that we seem to be doing comes out of anger. It's not a positive reaction. It's hatred and anger. okay, maybe I can't have it, but neither can you, and so I'm going to sabotage. And I think anger is a very easy emotion to spread around. It's very contagious. And you're seeing that with Brexit, you see that with Trump, you see that with a lot of the right-wing messages. It's like, we are tired, we are hungry, we're poor, we're angry, we're going to do this. I mean, with the latest Supreme Court justice, he was just angry. He was ranting. And some have pointed out that as a white privileged male, he should be the last person to be ranting. There's others who should be ranting more, but the people are angry. And I think that's what concerns me the most.
Why do you think people are angry?
I think there's a couple of things. Personally, I think that the model that we have built out over the last 50 years of what it means to be prosperous and how you achieve that has not lived up to its expectations. So there is an understanding that if you study hard enough, that if you go to a good university, then you will have a good job. And that was definition of success, and that was fine. And I think that worked very well in the post-World War II world where the alternative was fighting and huge instability and death. But as we've moved away from that, I don't think that model really works anymore. And so people are becoming disappointed by the fact that they've seemingly done everything right. They went to the good school, they married when they were supposed to, they got their 2.5 children and two cars and a house, and yet they're not happy. That hasn't made them fulfilled. And I think they're angry. And in some cases, they haven't even gotten the job. They haven't gotten the 2.5 cars and children. And they're angry because their expectations were not fulfilled. And I understand that completely. And the world is changing. There's increasingly this automation. So there's less jobs, especially for unskilled workers. There is less paths to victory. And again, going back to the first point about income inequality and all that, the system has built out a winner take all mentality where your self-worth, we're increasingly measuring our self-worth by the size of our bank account. There isn't any other yardsticks. How do I know that I'm smarter than you? Well, I have more money in my bank account. How do I know that I am better than you? Then, you know, it's because I have more money or I have a bigger house. And again, worked in the past, but now bigger houses don't make us happier. And that, I think, is creating a lot of problems because you just can't buy a bigger house that makes you angry. You bought a bigger house and it didn't make you happy. You're still angry.
Yeah. It's definitely focusing on like vanity metrics instead of like sanity metrics or something that's useful for you.
And to me, it's amazing, right? The statistics that whatever quarter of US population is on antidepressants and we're fatter than we've ever been and all of these things. So I think that all of that is making us unhappy.
Yeah, mental health's definitely been taking like a huge dive, which seems ridiculous when the world is better than it's ever been. But I think, like you alluded to when you talked about it, post-wars and when the alternative was going back into war, everyone's pretty happy with just not being like back to like perhaps killing each other. Yeah. Like I was in North Korea this year and everyone was quite happy because they weren't starving and then they're like really nice and it's like a bad thing to say, but they're grateful. Whereas we just grew up saying, oh, you can have everything, everything's fine. And then you don't get everything instantly. And you can only compare yourself to people that are doing better than you. And they're on social media having what seems like the time of their lives. Yeah. And you're like, oh, well, my life's kind of shit compared to everything else I can see around me.
There's a classic photo or cliche of international development where you have a teenager with the latest iPhone who's super unhappy because the phone maybe, you know, is only an 8 and not an X or whatever. And then you have a child with a soccer ball in India who is smiling from ear to ear because they have a soccer ball and it's just the happiest day of their life. Because before that, they were kicking rocks, right? They're playing football with rocks. And then, of course, you know, as a development agency or a person you come in and you're trying to lift them up so that every child in India can be as unhappy as a teenager because they'll finally be able to afford an iPhone. And that's a big dilemma in development.
Yeah. Always. I really like that analogy. Yeah, I spent a month living in Tasmanian woods with hippies without any technology. And I'm so happy all the time. Like, never had like a distraction device that's made me feel shit about things or not like look other people in the eyes. You just always present and nice.
Sure.
What is the kindest thing anyone has done for you?
I think for me, the kindest thing a person can do is open up and tell me about themselves and really tell me not necessarily what their problems are, you know, all these kind of things, but really kind of have a heart-to-heart conversation about the things that matter to them the most.
Okay, cool. How do people get better at doing that?
Well, it starts with you. So I didn't realize this conversation would go into these topics. This is great. But one of the things that I noticed is that as I started to change and as I started to open up to people, they open up to me. I think it starts with us. So if you want the world to be a certain place, you have to start acting as if it is. And then it will slowly start to conform to that. And I think that's true. So for me, it's been getting over my fear that people will not understand me, or if they get to know me, they will reject me. And to really kind of very quickly be able to talk about very intimate and deep things. And that's what I've seen. I mean, that probably goes back to the why people are unhappy. Mm-hmm. We've moved into this world of, and I don't like blaming social media for everything, because I think social media is a reflection of, if people didn't...
It's hard to, you don't really want to be like whiny and complaining.
That's it, right? Like everybody wants to put their best foot forward and say that their days are going great, but they don't. And sometimes things are good, sometimes things are bad. And being able to share that with people, I think, is really important. So one of the things that I've been actively trying to do is whenever I meet a new person, I will talk about very intimate things about my life that are happening. And I'm happy to explore and explain things that I'm dealing with or that I have been dealing with my whole life or whatever it might be. Very quickly. And that tends to create intimacy very quickly. There's a book on vulnerability that I read a while back that talked about the power of vulnerability. I think it's the most powerful thing that we have, actually. And if you can learn to be vulnerable, it opens up an entirely different dimension of being, but also a different dimension of connecting to people. And I think that's extremely important.
Cool. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for joining us this week on the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you head on to another episode, what was your biggest aha moment from today's discussion? Why don't you hit pause and ask yourself what you learned today? You can also share with us or me your insights by joining me on Reason.fm, a social podcasting player that I've built just to discover new podcasts and connect with other hosts and listeners and discuss things. And if you're a podcast host, you can now create your own show on Reason.fm for free, completely free. And that's all from me for today. So with that, please keep learning and keep growing.